I'm somewhere along the Longford-Westmead border, driving through our glorious Midlands on a mission.
Go on, Noel, what am I going to do for you?
That laugh belongs to Noel Kiernan, a forester, who's promised to introduce me to a remarkable conservation project on an island in a lake on the River Shannon. And we're trying to find out where to meet.
What are you driving?
I'm driving a long white Renault Megane.
But I first need to complete a task.
Well, I need you to pick up them oars.
Oars, of course. Where would you be without oars?
Go to the filling station, Mally's filling station at the upper end of the town.
Yeah.
It's a Topaz, is that what they call it?
That's it.
And I get my man to meet you there with the oars.
Brilliant.
And thus begins the very first step on a journey to discover the magical side of Ireland's natural heritage. But this is a journey with a difference. I want us to head off on an alphabet trail, meandering through the A to Z of Ireland's most offbeat, intriguing, and even revelatory natural wonders.
So this looks like the Topaz station.
Exactly. Now I need to find a man somewhere here with oars.
A journey of discovery from ants, ash trees and Arctic herbs to zephyrs, zooplankton and zombies.
Better put the back seat down in case these oars are really...
On this journey we expect the unexpected. Cuckoos and cormorants, dewdrops and disappearing lakes, extinct snails and eerie satellites.
I like it though. This is all adding up to this whole hero's journey. You know, if I fail on my first challenge to not either find the silvery old grey-haired man with a few words of Irish, to not get the oars, then everything else is going to fall apart.
So, for the next 5 nights, come with me and the producer, Colette, as we plunge ourselves into the alphabet soup of Ireland. Visiting places you may never have encountered, to see, smell, taste and listen to the wonders of Ireland's natural heritage.
I see a man with oars.
You do? Where's the man? Where are the oars? Oh, look. Aha. Hello to you. Dia hoch. Shin madi ra dasilish.
Yeah, madi ra. Jeshi me and the door nulli.
But before we go anywhere and get to use those oars even, let's dive straight into the first letter of the alphabet and kick this thing off on an A. A is going to be for Ice Age, as in age, age of ice. And so I head up the whole way to the most northerly point of our island, Malin Head, on the very tip top of County Donegal, where the ice would have clung on longest of all.
I'm standing on a rock overlooking this sheer drop into the Atlantic Ocean and north, straight for the North Pole.
14,000 years ago, the kilometre-thick layer of ice that covered Ireland melted back into the sea after 2.5 million years of repeated glaciation.
And on Malin Head, it looks like the Ice Age just happened, like a few decades ago. You can still see the land has been left entirely bare.
And after this age of ice, this land then witnessed a great arrival. The arrival of the first grasses and wildflower seeds that came tumbling into the barren tundra of Britain and Ireland. And they took root here, creating vast open meadows. Then, about 1,000 years later, the first juniper trees arrived. Stubby, rugged evergreens, preparing the way for a few lone birch seeds. Once even one of these stoic pioneer birches managed to take root and establish itself, it began sending out 15 million feather-light seeds each and every year to colonise the land and enrich the soil for others. Soon we had woodland, and along comes the giant deer and the reindeer. the hare, the otter, the Irish stoat and badger, the natterjack toad, and birds and bats and insects. And plants too, of course, like St. Debbuck's heath, fleabane, kidney saxifrage, and the arbutus tree, all coming across land bridges from the British mainland and across the ocean from Europe. What the glaciers left behind them became our playground. Here is where we blossomed as a race. We cleared the forests, worked the land to feed and shelter ourselves, and in doing so created much of the landscape that we know today. In some areas, the land created by our Neolithic ancestors still exists, preserved remarkably well, such as the Burren, a lunar-like landscape of barren grey limestone that was shaped beneath ancient seas and that now covers much of North Clare. On this alphabet trail, B is for the Burren, a place full of wonders. It's like an encyclopedia of human, plant and animal evolution. And I want to know how to fully read it. Fortunately, I know the perfect man to ask.
So we're now going to see Brendan Dunford, a scientist of some kind. And the story I heard was he once arrived in the Burren and was looking for like sheets of limestone paving spreading out as far as he could see. But it's not what he saw. Instead, he saw hazel, like these little hazel bushes, hazel scrub, scrubland taking over the place. And he thought, that whole Burren landscape and the Neolithic signs and everything that have been here for so long could in fact be entirely devoured by bushland if there's no farmers farming the area anymore. So he decided to do some research to see why the place was going under the control of bushland, and then he realised it was that farmers couldn't afford to put their cattle on the land anymore, and he decided he was going to have to come up with some scheme, with some project that could maybe rescue that. So I want to find out more about his idea, his plan, and why the limestone paving is so vital, is so key, is so unique in the world.
Moments after we meet him,
okay, I think we're here.
He's bounding off over the limestone landscape, pointing out the intricacies that I had never really considered.
The Burren is amazing because you have this big tablet of limestone. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the skeleton of our landscape, because over most of Ireland, or underneath most of the land of Ireland, lies limestone. Mm-hmm. But here in the Burren, the skeleton is clothed by a very kind of fragmented segment of vegetation. So right here we have bare pavement, then we have a very thin carpet of mosses and wild thyme and little herbs and little plantains and prunella, selfiel.
Is that thyme? So that is all...
That's all wild thyme.
Oh my,
yeah.
Tiny rough carpet.
Yeah.
And it's almost like little knots on an Axminster.
Yeah.
And the whole sheet is just, what, a centimetre thick or so?
Yeah, it's about a centimetre thick.
And then Brendan does something amazing.
Huh.
He literally rolls up the carpet of moss. He assures me that it won't kill them. And you can see how these plants are surviving on the barest of soil.
These plants here hadn't received water in about 6 weeks now. And then during the wintertime, they can be flushed completely with, you know, across the year, about 2 metres of rainfall. So it's a very difficult place for plants to grow. So your big bully plants, your dandelions and your strong grasses, they can't really survive here because they need a lot of nutrients, a lot of water. Whereas those small little compact plants like the wild thyme and the yellow rattle here and the birch for trefoil, they can survive in what's a very stressful growing environment. And that's why in the Burren, on a typical square metre, like what I'm picking up here now, mm-hmm. you can find about 40, 50 different plants in one square metre. And I often say to people when I come out here, is if you look at the green field in the distance, yeah. in that entire green field, you probably find 8 or 9 different species in the entire field. Whereas here, in a little square metre, you're going to find probably this looking at maybe 20, 30, up to 40 plants in that one square metre. And then when you've got those plants, you've got the smells, you've got the sounds, because there's so many wonderful plants here for bees and for butterflies that, you know, it's the basis of this really rich biodiversity, from snails to butterflies to all sorts that you'll find here. So, and not just visually, but in terms of the sounds and the smells as well, it's fantastic. It's a great place to be. Lovely thing about plants is every one of them has a story. It could be an old cure, it could be like this one over here. This is yarrow, and I met a lot of old farmers here who used to pick this plant and boil it in milk and rub it into their bones as a way of curing arthritis once upon a time. Another plant which is kind of growing on the wettish areas.
That's
here.
A complex looking thing, yeah.
It's a common enough plant, but it's called lousewort, and it likes wettish areas. And most plants which have wort in the name were used for some sort of herbal treatment or herbal medicine. So lousewort was once used to treat lice infections in hair, so we're told.
Awesome.
And just as I thought I had seen it all, Brendan points out one of the most beautiful flowers I've seen.
So right here we have a very special burn plant called Gentiana varna. It's an alpine plant.
Oh, the blue. It's called the intensity of that blue.
Absolutely. Good fabulous, God. Isn't it? And a little white throat right at the centre. Yeah. So this is one of the special, one of the iconic burn plants that you'll find.
It's almost like it's luminous, like there's a light bursting out from it.
Yeah.
The intensity of that.
In terms of the fauna then, I mean, we're walking across it, but this is a beautiful anthill. Right here, there's a little guy called the yellow ant, Lasius flavius, living under here. You have lots of snails. There's about 60 different species of snail in the burn because of all the calcium carbonate.
This richness is extraordinary. So basically, you can just keep on going. Each place we look is a new species.
And at the moment, we haven't even begun the flowering season. It hasn't really come into play yet. Just the first little plants are starting to appear in the landscape at the moment. But if you come back here, and we're out every week throughout the summer, you see a new suite of plants emerging.
This place blows my mind every time I see it, every time I immerse myself in it.
But what also blows my mind is how this landscape was created. First, by glaciers tearing away the surface soils and carving the limestone and depositing enormous erratics, the rocks. And then by water. But for me, the most surprising thing is learning that the other major sculptors of this landscape were human. Early farmers.
Now, normally, especially in the 21st century, when we think of human beings in nature, it's usually negative. And farming, especially, we think farming is really harming a lot of nature. It's about suppressing nature and shaping it towards a certain limited goal.
But that's not the case in the Burren. Stone Age farmers realised the limestone kept its warmth through winter. And so they'd bring cattle up here to graze on the dry stone flags. The cattle are then brought down off the burn in summer, when there is no water for them here.
So in the summertime, when the cattle aren't around, the flowers are blooming here, and it's fantastic. Then in wintertime, when the flowers die back and become dormant, the cattle come in, they hoover up all the dead vegetation, and following spring, the little lice can get through to the tiny seedlings and little flowers can prosper, flower and set seed unhindered by livestock or by anything else.
Ingenious. So
this is what the burn would look like for 2 years without farming. So we have a little section here which hasn't been grazed maybe in several years. And what happens is, literally, the dead vegetation builds up. You can see it, I'm pulling it out here. So the role of the cow every year is to, every winter, is to come and eat back all that grass. And by doing that, then the light can get into the ground layer, activate the seedlings, and the seedlings can come out.
So farming is vital. It's key to the complexity of the area, of the biodiversity.
Exactly, but the right type of farming is the key thing. The right type of farming. The wrong type of farming can destroy the burn. We need the right type of farming. The human nature story often is a negative one, particularly in modern society. But in the burn, it's actually a lovely symbiotic relationship.
The complexity of this symbiotic relationship is so alluring. What at first seems like a grey expanse of rock turns out to be this multi-layered, interdependent, almost intelligent system. But there's one thing that I'm still not getting. This idea that the burn has thousands of tiny microclimates within each square metre. I've heard it's to do with these things called clints and grikes, but I'm hazy about the details. Brendan points directly below my feet at a thin crevice in the rock and says it's a grike. Yeah, but what's a grike?
So a grike is this kind of crack that we find between the rock.
It's this huge split. It's like a sliver, the most narrow canyon I've ever seen.
Sometimes you have these recurring dreams about land cracking like an earthquake underneath you. We were standing on either side of the
San Andreas Fault.
Exactly, exactly. And we call those grikes or scalps. So you have the clints, which are the blocks of rock, and then the grikes beneath. But down the grikes, it's very sheltered. It's quite dark. It's very moist. So it's more like a woodland climate, and you get all these woodland plants growing down in the Greig there. Whereas up on top of the rock, it's a really arid, bright, hot landscape with a completely different set of plants. So within a couple of inches of each other, you have two completely contrasting environments.
Like 3 foot above, here I'm standing on this barren, bleak, almost like desert-like rock, and then down below that rich, fetid, sort of tropical, looking down upon it, it looks that rich, tropical type of woodland. Like, so all around us is this limestone pavement with this phenomenally complex plants and microflora. But then, as you're saying, beneath us will always be often caves and caverns and in a whole other realm. Mm. So you sort of need to think on different layers. You need to widen your expansion than one ever does normally think.
Exactly. There's the whole underworld here, which is extraordinary. And one lovely story from just across the way from here where we're sitting is there's a cave found a good while back, but it was excavated in the last, I think, about 15 years ago by Dr. Marion Dowd from IT Sligo. She found amazing treasures in the cave, but she also found some human bone, which, because of the cave being very dark and humid, the bone is well preserved. And she was able to extract some DNA from the cave, from the marrow of the bone, rather, and build up a DNA profile of that person in the cave. And then she took some DNA samples from the local school kids around here, and three of the kids, their DNA profile was a match with that of the cave dweller.
Come on.
And that cave dweller had died 3,500 years ago.
You're not serious.
And those kids, those families are living within, in one case, within a kilometre of the cave.
So you direct can see the descendants of 3,500 years.
And that shows the kind of the connection people have with this place.
Holy Mary.
How long that connection goes back.
That you can even find DNA from marrow of that old. That is, so that's a rooted people. That's people not only rooted to the, you know, to the landscape, to the caves, to the nature. That is on a whole other level, isn't it?
Yeah, it is amazing how far it goes back.
It just makes you see your place in the landscape in a far more humble position, you know?
Yeah.
We're only a tiny part of some super complex going around.
What's lovely about it is that we can stand here and we can, you know, put our hands on this vegetation and smell the flowers and listen to the bird life around us. We can crawl through Neolithic wedge tombs. There's about 100 of them here. We can pretend that we're Stone Age farmers. We can, you know, we can look at these wonderful Greigs and cave systems. It's a very immersive learning landscape, really. That's, you know, and then superimposed upon all of that, I think we have the human story, which thankfully in recent years has become a story around sustainability. So you have all these wonderful learning dimensions.
Cuckoo. Do you hear the cuckoo? My first cuckoo of the year. That was the sound of my childhood. I hadn't heard the cuckoo for 10 years until 2 years ago. I had an Inish ear. It's my second time since my childhood.
I often tell my kids to enjoy the sound because it might be here when you're my age. Yeah.
And we're back to the sudden precariousness of nature again. How all of this could be in danger as the effects of humankind impact the habitat of birds like the cuckoo. It's ironic that we who force such change on the landscape are now its primary guardians. Brendan, there's like no one can unlock that landscape like you. It does require someone like you, so a scientist, to be able to unlock that thing. Just to show us the wonders. Thank you for that.
Not at all. You make it sound like hard work, but it's a real pleasure. And, you know, at the burn, just take a walk and have a look at it and enjoy the sounds and the smells. And it becomes this addictive landscape. And then, you know, you thirst for more knowledge and information and awareness. And then you're on this, as I have been, on this wonderful learning journey. So the thing about love about here is there's always something new to see. There's always something new to learn. So I know the longer I stay here, the more I realize how little I know about the burn. So, you know, looking forward to learning more in the years ahead. But thanks for coming.
You're listening to the A to Z of Ireland, an alphabetical trip through our natural heritage. We've just left B for the Burren. And that cuckoo call makes me think we could move on to C for cuckoo. But actually, I think the thing that is really stirring me now is the whole concept of birdsong. So let's not rush off anywhere. Let's stay on B for birdsong. And just as Brendan Dunford helped me understand the secret life of the Burren, not too far from here, there's a person who can help me unlock the intricacies of the secret language of the sky. If I can find out where he lives, of course.
I love it. Like, Ireland's so tiny, and yet it is so easy to get lost.
But eventually...
There he is.
Ah, brilliant.
We find our way to the home of ornithologist and nature artist Gordon Darcy.
I knew I was going to rely on my body to
You're
find
very
this
welcome.
Place. Thank
Morning.
You so
intuitive,
much.
Intuitive. How
you doing?
You must be Colette.
Colette, very nice
How
to
you
meet
doing,
you. How are
Colette?
You?
How about
this? Stepping into his garden, it immediately becomes clear that this is someone who is in tune with nature. The garden of his bungalow is full of mature trees, bee and butterfly bushes.
We've got reeds and horsetails and all sorts of wetland plants growing in there.
Look at that. Basically the food, the plants of the dinosaurs coming in at you.
It's a tiny haven for him and for all these birds, insects and small mammals who seek shelter here. What I envy most about Gordon Darcy is his knowledge of all these twitterings and warblings and operatic cantatas that mean nothing to me.
It's funny, I keep thinking that everyone knows a blackbird and a song thrush. And, you know, the warbling birds. But in fact, they don't. Oh, blackbird. You get the blackbird there? Throaty sort of the song. Yeah, did you get that? There it goes again. That's the blackbird.
And so why are the birds calling?
They're actually not calling, they're singing. They're singing, and there's a difference. Call is a communicatory sound that all birds make, usually little short, sharp notes, ticks and chirps. But when a bird sings, it's a male bird that's declaring his territory, and he's trying to make it as attractive a sound as he can. A lot of people don't realise that it's the male bird that does the singing, whether it's a cuckoo, whether it's a willow warbler, a chaffinch, or a pheasant, which makes a kind of a claxton-like sound. It's still the male bird trying to attract a female, but also declaring territory so that other birds of the same species will know that I won't go into that patch because that patch belongs to that particular male bird and that family of birds, if you like. So that's what song's about. There's the wren now. Do you hear how loud that is? That's a tiny little bird that size.
Size of a matchbox.
Yeah. He's just behind us here in the oak. Hear the little trill in the middle?
Yeah.
Like that in the middle? So it's got a song that's in sections with a trill in the middle.
That's it.
Lively, excitable. There it goes again.
But you're saying the singing is actually an intimate thing.
It's an intimate thing. We're kind of privileged just to sit in on it, if you like. And, you know, the amount of music that's been derived from bird songs, just phenomenal. You know, if you think of the lark and the clear air, the Irish traditional music, or any of the big composers, they've all derived inspiration from the natural world, and particularly bird song. Oh.
What am I hearing now? What should I be listening to?
You're listening to a willow warbler, which is a 5-gram feathered object that flies all the way from Africa every year to be with us for the summer. It's got that beautiful lilting song. It starts high and cascades down. You hear it in just a second.
That one.
That one. That one. And it repeats and it repeats and repeats and sings from a tree like that. Lilting, melodic, cascading. Those are the words I would use with that song. And when I'm with people and they want to learn the bird song, that's the kind that I got.
Like some really gentle person coming down the stairs.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. You could get it, you know, whatever way you see that song. Yeah.
And you wait when you get into it, you're waiting for the last note. You know it has to drop.
That's like, right.
So if it suddenly stopped halfway down the stairs, you're going.
Oh no, he's in full song there at the moment. He's telling there's another willow warbler over and those willows over there. Uh-huh. And he's saying more or less, you know, keep out. It's a very polite way of doing it. I mean, people would run around with a club and hit one another over the heads if they encroached on their territory. But birds do it in a gentle sort of artistic way. Chiff chaff. Did you hear the chiff chaff? He goes... Psst, 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 psst.
do things like willow warblers come from far away? We just come here for the summer?
Yes, for the summer.
And so, you know, every school child knows in Ireland about the swallow coming from the
yes.
summer. But, and we think that's the only bird.
A lot of people, that's right. There's loads of them.
What else?
Oh, goodness gracious. There's half a dozen warblers. Black cap, the willow warbler, the chiff-chaff, the sedge warbler, the grasshopper warbler. And then you have birds like the swallow, the house martin, the swift, the sand martin.
I know the quail does as well, doesn't it?
The quail, the corncrake, they're summer visitors as well. The seashore birds like terns, they're only there for the summer.
So why also do we only focus on the swallow? We celebrate the swallow doing this great journey.
Well, it's because it's the harbinger of the spring and summer, I think. It's one of the first ones to arrive, and it's a very obvious bird. It's also a very cheery bird. Hmm. It has a very attractive twitter, and people love to see the swallow around. It's benign, you know, catches insects. Oh, did you hear the chiff-chaff? He goes...
I have that exciting feeling in my head of having my world expanded. Now okay. Every time that calls, I'm in tune with a part of the thing that I was totally
there
ignorant
you are.
To.
There you are.
I'm left with a feeling of elation after being with Gordon Darcy. Suddenly aware of entire conversations and concerts in the sky that I never tune into. And my head is buzzing with the notion of all the songs and tunes that might actually have been composed, or at least inspired, by birds. So it's tempting to stay here and immerse myself in the birdsong, but I remember something I read in a book Gordon wrote about an interesting creature from the Burren that I'd love to know more about. It's a type of periwinkle that used to live in the tidal zone of the ocean, but then it upsticks and moved on land, developing an entirely new respiratory system to breathe air. It spread right across Ireland, a great success story, until it wasn't. This little creature is called the landwinkle.
Everyone's got their own description for it. It's very elegant. I mean, the name is perfect, Pomatius elegans. It's an elegant snail, very small, only a centimetre in height, with a round entrance, a round-mouthed entrance, sometimes called the round-mouthed snail. And it's the usual spiral that you'd expect in a snail, but very compact spiral that looks like a turban or like I think you would describe it as a 99 without the chocolate.
And suddenly, the producer, Colette, comes up with an idea.
So if you were to challenge Moncon to go and find a landwinkle, where would you send him?
I'd send him to Fleck.
You'd send me where, Gordon? Where? The car drowned out his words, which maybe is best, as Gordon is pretty protective of his snails.
I don't want to sort of broadcast this, because I don't want everyone going in there and digging up the landwinkle from where it is.
What he was willing to reveal was that it's somewhere between Ballyvaughan and Kinvara. It's close to the shore, in a field with a beware of the bull sign on it.
Okay, so I'm looking for the top of an ice cream on the shore with a perfect circular mouth.
Yeah.
And is it, you know, the periwinkles can sometimes be black and purple and sort of petrol coloured?
No, this is lilac coloured.
Lilac coloured.
So a light kind of bluish, pinkish, purple, that kind of colour.
Okay, that's a challenge. So I'm going to see, can I find the one place in Ireland where this precious landwinkle can still be found?
You go for it.
Super. Thanks, Gordon.
And off we go to find the landwinkle and our next letter in the alphabet of Ireland's natural heritage. But it's not the obvious L. I think it would be far better to file this one under C for catastrophe, or maybe cock-up or calamity. Because when this tiny periwinkle changed direction all those millions of years ago, it was essentially sealing its own fate and moving slowly towards its own extinction. While it still thrives in southern Europe, it's now barely hanging on in its one remaining Irish location. But seeing as this whole challenge was Colette's idea, let her pick up the story from here.
So we're back in the car, making our way through the many roads that meander through the Burren. Now, I have a pretty poor sense of direction, and I have no idea where I am. And it looks like it'll stay that way.
I can say where I am now has a link to George Washington, but I'm not telling you any more than that.
No, this is serious. We need to protect this poor little landwinkle.
So the only landmark I can look out for is a gate with a Beware of the Bull sign on it.
Oh, I think I might have gone too far.
And just as it looks as if we mightn't even find our field, never mind the landwinkle.
Oh, it's Beware of the Bull. Perfect, I've just reversed into it. Let's go looking for a landwinkle. Basically, 99 ice cream cones is what we're looking for in the form of a shell.
So this leads me to think we'll be successful in our quest.
So there's Beware of the Bull. So I'm climbing the Beware of the Bull gate.
Until I see the size of the field.
I was hoping this would be easier.
Because it's more like an area of limestone paving the size of a soccer pitch, corralled by some dry stone walls.
Like, it just looks like all big grey lumps of lava. It's obviously limestone that has been distressed and broken up by erosion and weathering, but I don't see any place here that I'm likely to find a shell. I need to find it somewhere which might have little bits of sand or bits of smaller stones.
But we forge optimistically on, hopping over the slabs of pavement, then hunkering down and sifting through the debris of soil and sand.
So I'm going through holes. This is where, like, the limestone would have just been, with onion weathering, would have just broken off in the frosts of previous year, and it's gone down to stones, to really sharp stones and to shiny sand. I'm just thinking, well, might they be hiding? Oh, landwinkles, come out.
And for a moment, it looks really good.
Right there, what's that?
We see a promising shell.
Huh.
But it's just an innocent snail, minding its own business.
Hear that? He started hissing at me, the snail. He started hissing at me. Well, a thin snail, which I don't know what the type is, but isn't a landwinkle. And I picked him up and he started making noises. Sorry about that.
And on we go again, hopping and ducking, sifting and scouting, but also discovering many other gems of nature along the way.
There's all sorts of ferns and ivies.
And even the stones themselves are to be admired.
It's amazing all the different forms the limestone can take. It can be really craggy and broken up. It can be in little sharp pebbles. It can be in slates.
Until about 15 minutes in.
Well, look at that. Oh my God, wait there. I think it's a 99. There's a little ice cream cone, a perfect spiral. It's just like a whelk shell, but tiny, tiny, teeny. And there's a perfect round opening. I have found my first landwinkle. So obviously it isn't alive anymore, but that is phenomenal. I have found an actual landwinkle in the only place in Ireland where it still exists. And there's no way I'm going to let yous know where it is. It's so beautiful. He's thinner than the periwinkle. Obviously, life on the land was easier than life on the shore, where you have the tide rocking you every few hours back and forth. It's sort of sad. I know, I'm so happy I found him, but I'm sort of sad he's not alive. Do you know?
Do you have your phone on you?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you take a photograph?
That's a great idea. Okay. I'm going to put him down that limestone. Put on macro and then...
So here's a question now. What's the ethics of taking or leaving this little
animal? Oh, I was immediately thinking I was going to take him and guard him forevermore. But of course, this is where he lives, you're right.
But it's dead, right?
It's dead, yeah, I know, but the shell is from this area. It's not for me to decide to bring it somewhere else. No, I'm going to have to put him back. It's like I've done that catch and release thing. You told me not to take the photo. That is basically I've caught and release. I can go to the pub and boast like I got a fish this size. I got a landwinkle.
Size of your fingernail.
Yeah, maybe I should date stamp it. Should I get a copy of the newspaper and take a copy of the landwinkle with the newspaper to prove great? I should text that to Gordon. So good, I found myself a landwinkle. Really happy with that. Okay, let's go. So we're back on track with our epic journey through the alphabet of Ireland's natural heritage. And time to move on to a whole new letter, D. For this, I've come to what some describe as Ireland's last really wild area. A place apart that has a real allure. It's the most complex smell here. It's a smell that you just don't get in cities. It smells... there's a little bit of turf to it. There's a sweetness, a sort of a sort of like a meadow sweet sort of sweetness to it. It just is something very relaxing about it. There's something really homely. There's a purity to it that is it's uncanny.
But it's not just any ordinary wild area. This is a dark sky park, the second one in Ireland, designated by the International Dark Sky Association to areas that have not yet been polluted by the glare of artificial light. We're realising now that we need the darkness, pitch darkness. We need it, and the insects, animals and plants definitely do too. The problem is, this is summer in Ireland and it never gets dark. It's 10:30 p.m. but it's still so bright. So I'm going to head out first to explore this part of Mayo. Breed Colquhoun, head guide of Ballycroy National Park, has agreed to show me around.
Breed, where have you brought me here?
This is the Robert Lloyd Prager Centre, which is part of the Letterkenny Woods area, which is about 15 kilometres, I think, north of Newport. So it's a really nice area for camping and hiking, but it traditionally would have been famous for hiking along the Bangor Trail as a stop-off and also as a stop-off along the Western Way.
The Bangor Trail and the Western Way are two long-distance trekking routes in the west of Ireland that take in some spectacular and weather-ravaged scenery.
And so, like, it's in, you know, it's early, it's evening, like, light is falling and we're in an area of old, like, Cuilta forest that the trees look sort of spent and tired. But beyond me, like, it looks like we're on the edge of wilderness, that beyond this, like, gravel road gets some really wild.
We really are. If we set off along the Bangor Trail, we're winding through the Nathan Begg mountain range, which is the main body of Ballycroy National Park and also Wild Nathan Wilderness Area. You have to go from here about 30 kilometres before you see the next house if you're travelling north.
Good God.
Yeah, so
should
it's an
we start
amazing
off
area.
Some?
Okay. So we're going to actually cross the river in a few minutes. It'll be the Altacani River in this area. So it's a really famous area for salmon fisheries, lots of nice wildlife like otters and things like that. So it's just a gorgeously remote area with not many people around.
So I can hear the river ahead and I can see this band of sort of sad looking old conifers, but the main thing I'm feeling are these midges. I'm being devoured by midges.
Yeah, well, everyone hates the midges apart from me, actually. So
you love the midges?
I love the midges. Why? Yeah, they are just food for all the fish, food for all the other insects and creepy crawly things in the water. But actually, when they emerge as adults, they make great food then for bats, for swifts, for swallows. They really are like the first part of the food chain. They're just super important.
But let's not forget the plants. This is a hard place for plants to survive, but the ones that are here have ingeniously adapted to life in nutrient-poor soil. They eat insects.
Well, they digest insects. So the sundew has a lovely sweet sugary honeydew and it kind of glistens and little midges will sit on it or flies or spiders and the sundew then will actually start to digest it and it'll get nutrition from it. The butterwort is another lovely one. It kind of catches them and it's got a long leaf, a long green leaf that actually rolls up, the two sides roll up and capture the insect in the middle of it. Yeah, not so fast, but as a Venus flytrap, but if you stood for a few minutes you'd actually see it happening. Yeah,
wow.
And that's how they get their nutrition.
So we continue over this bridge and get into the wood.
Yeah.
So right ahead of us is just this roaming prairie land, like the sort of the Scottish estates. It's just looked like a big long prairie leading up into a hill, sort of undulating hills. Nothing too high, although that looks really quite sheer ahead of us.
It's interesting, there was a reintroduction project of sea eagles in the south and golden eagles in the north of Ireland, and some of them were satellite tagged, and we've actually seen their satellite tagged birds come back here, and this would have been the last stronghold of them in Ireland.
Of the eagles?
Of the white-tailed eagle, yeah, and golden eagle, Achill Island, Ballycroy National Park. This mountain range was one of the last strongholds, until maybe even the 1930s, I think one of the last birds was, but it was a bit before that that they kind of were finally wiped out, unfortunately.
And is the idea now to create places where people can encounter this wild Ireland?
Yeah, there's no roads in here, there's no phone coverage. You might meet one person on it if you're lucky, but if you really want to enjoy the Bangor Trail, it's an overnight walk. You can overnight up in the middle of it, and there's little waterfalls, there's lakes along it, there's rivers and streams, and it's just the most magical place.
But it's also a place filled with midges. And although I'm 6 foot tall and have swum with sharks and survived attacks by rabid dogs, the midges have me driven to distraction.
The two of us have the weirdest body language now. We're just constantly pawing at each other, at ourselves, and scratching and pointing with midges, different things. You know, if someone saw this from afar, they'd think, what are they doing?
Yeah. Excuse me, I'm actually choking on midges.
On midges. Here, let's get some shelter.
So we decide to move into the bothy, our bully hut, here at the trailhead. The type that shepherds would have used as a refuge and is now ideal for trekkers.
Whoa.
It offers us some respite from the midges and the chance of some hot chocolate. It's completely dark inside, by the way, apart from an unusual headlamp that Georgia McMillan is wearing as she mixes the milk.
Why, you're the first person I've ever seen goes camping with a red light rather than a white light. Is there a reason?
The red light preserves your night vision. All of us have night vision, it's just we don't use it very often. So it's just some way to try and keep our natural night vision.
This is Georgia McMillan, and she has a real interest in preserving not only her own night vision, but everyone else's too. She's the driving force behind the Dark Sky Park that we're in now. The status is awarded by the International Dark Sky Association in Arizona, which is the leading organization combating light pollution worldwide. They work to encourage communities and governments to preserve the integrity of the night sky for future generations. So here in County Mayo, Georgia set up the Dark Skies Initiative to help raise awareness of light pollution, but also to show us why we need the dark.
Our body clock and our systems have evolved into day and night cycles, so we need darkness to sleep, and traditionally, before we had artificial light, we would have done that naturally, we would have worked during the day and we would have slept at night.
Reid, if George is saying that it's key for us to get darkness and to have an absence of white light, does that also apply to animals, to wildlife?
It does, absolutely. The circadian rhythm in animals is affected, quite similar to the humans. It can be quite devastating on a bird's physical well-being and things like that, and hormonal changes as well. I know in the UK they've done a lot of research on blackbird hormones and things like that have been affected.
Blackbirds are being affected by light on all day and all night.
Yeah.
They're changing.
Yeah, their hormones are unbalanced and creating some kind of aberrations in the birds, actually. The main thing that I see the influence on in my own experience is the stressors on animals and on wildlife.
What do you mean?
If you see foxes, you know, their normal thing is to be in shadows and hedges, mm-hmm. and in the dark. Whereas when they're now around cities and urban areas, they're more exposed, so it might make it harder for them to find prey, things like that.
But they're thriving in cities. They're doing better than...
Well, people. Not because of light, though. Probably because of our lifestyles of rubbish and... I don't think it's just about animals or just about people. I think it's very much everything is affected by light.
Which is why Georgia and others in the Dark Skies campaign are worried that we're making our towns and cities too bright.
Who's first up?
And the trend for introducing new LED streetlights, which mimic daylight, is not good for the humans or non-humans who live near them. So they're trying to encourage us to dim our lights, both inside our homes and out on the streets.
So you're now a sort of a campaigner, an impassioned explainer of why we need the dark, but you do it in such a beautiful way. We're in this bothy, in this gorgeous stone-built hut on the edge of an area of wilderness, and you just made us hot chocolate. Like, there's no sweeter, nicer way to introduce, to move us towards the dark.
Come on to the dark side.
And it's been amazing, Georgia, hasn't it? It's been so positive. We've had no negativity or no bad feedback. And we don't want to take anyone's lights away. We just would kind of kindly ask that they might direct them properly.
It's a new way of thinking that we weren't used to in Ireland at all. This way of thinking of other, of nature's need rather than our own direct need.
But we have a habit of, I think, thinking that if the way to light up is the progressive way. Whereas, you know, if we did have it right, and we're just using the light because it seems like light is good, dark is bad. So it's that train of thought. So it's a cultural shift as well. You know, we're not anti-light.
I think just listening to you there, Georgia, I'm kind of reminded that this hut, or this style of hut even, there must be people for hundreds of years doing this, you know? This is our natural habitat, is to sit in the dark around a little fire and having a chat, you know, kind of getting to know each other. I think it's actually something that people have innate in them. It's something we can't get away from. There's no, why do we do it? It's more like, well, why aren't we doing it? I think, rather than the other way.
I think that everyone likes hot chocolate.
As I sip my hot chocolate, listening to Breed and Georgia in the pitch darkness, I realise it's now a perfect time for stargazing. And so we move outside and look up.
That's phenomenal.
So I'm pointing at the pan of Ursa Major, or really we know it as the plough. There's the pan. So those two stars line up, and they point to the North Star, which is over here.
Oh, look at that.
So that's Polaris. Mm-hmm. It's in line. And if
right
we
above
it's right above us. So, and that's that. That was the way that before we had compasses that people looked at navigation and used that star to navigate.
And then you had one very bright planet again. It's gone behind clouds.
Yeah, we had Jupiter earlier. In the evening, and just with a pair of binoculars you can get a great view of Jupiter, especially at this time of year, and the key moons surrounding Jupiter, so that's quite a treat.
So on a cloudy night like tonight, where you're not seeing the full constellation, it requires some skill to be able to pick out some.
Well, I'm only learning, just as we go along.
I wonder, is this the natural world, or is this the beyond nature? It's beyond the, like, it's a whole other realm, you know? Normally we go out into nature to experience nature. When you're going beyond, when you're going out into other galaxies and other almost solar systems beyond, I don't know, it becomes interplanetary then.
But do you think it's just completing our picture, really? It's something we perhaps don't always think of. Our vision tends to end on the horizon. When we're out in nature, we look and we appreciate the land or the sea. We don't often cast our eye above the horizon into the sky, so I suppose that's what this is about, just connecting everything, and it's our natural heritage.
Yeah.
That's Jupiter, the brightest one you can see, there in the south. And the satellite just behind Colette here.
It's so beautiful here that I don't want to leave. I want us all to be able to stay, you included, enjoying the night sky.
Oh my God, do you just see there, we've got the International Space Station actually just going underneath, going behind the trees.
Yeah, behind the trees. Yeah.
But this hero's journey, this alphabetical trip through Ireland's natural heritage, has almost come to a close for tonight. But it's not over yet. For D needn't just stand for dark skies. It can be for diversion too. Which is precisely what we're going to take, a diversion.
I think we turn left here.
Remember those oars I was meant to pick up right at the start of this journey? Remember? A farmer named Noel Kiernan asked me to fetch him some oars as he wanted to show me something really special on a lake in the Midlands. A conservation project. Well, We have the oars now, and we're in Noel's car, me and the producer Colette.
The oars are like talking to us.
And we're on our way to Loch Ree on the River Shannon, where Noel is hoping to introduce us to an increasingly rare and endangered bird that was once common throughout Ireland, but now survives in only a few remote spots like this.
Look at that view. Oh my God. And like the cruelest thing, Noel, is how Loch Ree is just ignored.
Well, it's Ireland's best kept secret, they say.
Okay, the bird we're after is the curlew, Ireland's largest wader, once common in our bogs and wetlands, and popular because of its repeated keening crescendo call. So, we arrive at the secret location beside the lake.
Have you caught?
No.
Okay, well, I'll have to see what I can...
We're on low-lying Marley sheep fields on the Longford side of Loch Ree.
Cap?
I'll take one.
It'll be a short row out to the island.
You're not wearing a life jacket?
It's a lady's force. It's a bit like the tight pants.
Women and children first.
And Noel, who knows this precarious and even tempestuous lake well, takes to the oars. The beginning of the final step on my hero's journey.
I've achieved all the steps so far, Noel.
Yes, but it's moody. It's a lake with several moods.
We can start into the rosary if you want.
We're not rosary material yet.
Okay.
If an oar breaks.
And when we land on the island, a ferocious wind makes it hard to hear each other, never mind the curlew.
Would you be able to hunker down here for a small fish?
You often have to do this.
I do.
Hunkering down.
I do, in strange places.
And as we huddle in the shelter of a dry stone wall, I get a chance to ask Noel about his motivation.
So what is it about the curlew that has a hold on you, Noel?
Interested in nature since I was an infant almost. It stayed with me all through my career as a forester. And I suppose once I realised the curlew was in danger, it was all hands to arms then.
I used to spend my summers in Kerry in the Dingle Peninsula, yeah? And so the sound of the childhood, the summer, was just the corncrake. And when I heard it again, I had this like evocative, this really passionate longing, this sadness. And is it a bit the same with you at the curlew? Like, that was your sound. You used to hear that in the background, and then it was only when it was gone that you suddenly had this sort of illogical, this emotional reaction that,
yeah,
I need to protect.
That's exactly it. And for most people, it's the same. It's just that to happen, being able or had the time to do anything about it or didn't know how to do anything about it, whereas I suppose I'm in a position where I can do something about it now, this stage of my life, and because I live beside the lake and close to them, it gives me a sense of achievement if we can see the numbers rise.
So far we haven't been able to hear this elusive call, and we hunker and strain our ears until
this girl.
We see a familiar shape hovering in the distance.
Just watch it coming in there now.
Come on, where?
Watch him.
Can you see him?
He's behind the trees.
Right.
See, watch him. Look.
Look at him.
Look at the display.
Oh my God.
Look at the display now.
It's like a hawk with the arms.
It is, but he's holding in the breeze there. I think it's because it's a windy day he's able to do that, but normally it's dipping.
Right.
Up and down and dipping up.
Isn't
and down.
Isn't that beautiful?
And then it finally happens. It is, hands down, the most evocative of calls. And the bird itself is such a graceful gymnast of the sky. I can see now how Noel got so entranced. Seeing him relax as he watched and listened to the bird made it clear just how deep his connection to the curlew is. So we got to hear and see one of five breeding pairs on this island that I don't intend to name. So carefully and lovingly nurtured and protected by Noel Kiernan. And I feel I now understand why he does this. It's not just for himself. I think it's for all of us, and for the birds themselves, because they're part of nature, just as we are.
He's doing his dive there now again.
and he's answering the other male on the other side.
Our alphabetical journey through the wonders of Ireland's natural heritage has only just begun. In our next episode, we're going to be looking at eagles and bees, nettles and ice cream, bats and Bronze Age farms.
Tender as a tender rose.